Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
It's time now for Radio I on ABC Radio National.
I'm going to tell you how to do resuscitation, all right?
They can be warped or distorted.
It's just a luck of the draw.
Graphic representation of sound.
And it's just gone thwack, splat.
That's what I call the plane of cohesion.
I just felt every eye was on me.
Radio I.
Hi and welcome to Radio I, stories of people, places and ideas from across the country and around the world. I'm Brent Clough. And today we're taking a journey from one Hollywood to another with Doris Goddard. In the 1950s, she was a Tinseltown actress, rubbing shoulders with the rich and famous, Bob Hope, Katharine Hepburn, Sid James. Now she stars in her very own Hollywood. The Hollywood Hotel in the back streets of Sydney's Surrey Hills, that is. She's been running the pub for over 30 years and has retired to the other side of the bar. But at 77, Doris still draws the attention of anyone who drops in for a drink. And without too much twisting of the arm, will hop up and belt out a song or two. Regina Boutros found herself drawn into the world of Doris Goddard, her triumphs, travails, tunes and travels. This is A Tale of Two Hollywoods.
Quiet! Please, ladies and gentlemen, could you put your hands together for Miss Doris Goddard?
Come into my parlor, said the spider to the fly. I'll wrap you up in silk and I will love you. We all feed on each other in loving as in life, the child, the parent and the lover, the husband and the wife.
The Hollywood, I guess like any sort of old film, it does feel a little bit musty, but it does have a sense of nostalgia that is very rare in a lot of pubs, particularly in around Sydney that I'm aware of.
We spoke to Doris 20 years ago for an interview for the ABC, and this pub has not changed in that time. It's exactly the same. Every time I've walked into it, it's the same.
It's an old 50s style sort of bar. It's what you'd expect to walk into in a speakeasy place in Hollywood or something like that. This little dive joint, but like, it's saved by its just style and panache everywhere else.
I become the spider.
I got to meet Doris firstly when she actually did a little impromptu performance, and everyone was just sort of awestruck, and I think she does like to have that kind of attention in the room.
We get the prettiest girls here in the hotel.
Thanks, Doris.
I recall that a lot of your songs have a political element.
Yeah, an old bloke came into the pub, put his money on the bar. He wanted smokes, but he was told he was short by far. He learned the tax had been increased to help preserve the nation's health. For smokers are a selfish lot, get sick and drain Australia's wealth. And drinkers too, no doubt, he said as he plonked his dollars down and sadly murmured in his beer, the wowsers sure are winning now. The wowsers always find a way to take a poor man's joys away. It's goodbye to sinning, like smoking and drinking and winking at women. They'll stop us from grinning. I smoke, I drink, it's all I've got. For all the work I've given to this great country. Ah, but now the wowsers sure are winning. when I think there was, you know, there was things about people drinking too much. Well, undoubtedly some people drink too much. The majority of people drink within their drinking capacity. The majority of people. But you're always going to get somebody that you know, they can't resist the big drugs or the, you know, but that's up to them. You can't blame the whole population.
I keep getting this visual image of, you said if more politicians drank in pubs.
In the old days, of course, I'm going back to, you know, probably the 20s or something like that, they did drink in pubs because that's where they learned what the people were thinking and they made their platform according to what the people were thinking. They don't do it now. Johnny Norton, for example, I don't suppose if you know, but he founded the Truce newspaper. And he was a pub drinker and he knew what was going on. But I'm going back a lot of years. I was not there then, let me just say this. But he was a very famous knockabout Sydney sider.
I thought the man whose face bespoke his grief. He stood erect, reserved, composed, correct.
I've been playing here since 2000. And then there was a jam night here on Monday nights. That was the first time I met Doris. And she was always regularly going there and playing a guitar and singing songs. During the week, there were various sort of things. In fact, some bands are huge. I met one of those gypsy bands, Masala, when they were just starting up. They were at least 10-piece bands. And, many various people. I saw Billy Connolly down here, the comedian. I saw Daniel Johns from Silverchair was down here. A few members of The Chaser were down here. She does have a CD that she released ages ago with her tunes, but it's a funny sort of character because she is a diva but doesn't want extreme limelight, you know. She's quite happy with her riches that she made in the past.
I am a man vulnerable.
Do you get up still and to sing a solo tune?
I still get up occasionally and sing and play, but then I'm 77 now, darling, and you know, I'm losing the impetus, I suppose. Impetus.
Do you think I could record you sometime when you get up?
Oh, darling, I can give you one of my records. It's much easier than recording.
And gentle time.
One of the particular features of the Hollywood is the photographs that are of Doris from her heyday. And when she sort of perches herself up on the bar stool with a glass of red in her hand, on one side of the bar you have the real thing at a different sort of time and era. And on the other side of the bar you have these montage of beautiful pictures and photographs of her. Some have been in the newspaper, published in magazines as well. Others are actually photographic portraits of a woman that did extremely well on the silver screen.
Well, you're terrific if you're even good.
I wondered if you could give me a tour of your board, the things that you've done.
You want a tour of the board?
Okay. This film with Bob Hope, what film was that?
That was The Iron Petticoat with Bob Hope and Catherine Hepburn. That's Catherine Hepburn up there. You can see Sidney Jones just behind her and I'm just behind her too.
Captain Charles Lockwood, liaison officer, U.S. Air Force, to see Colonel Scarnoff.
You have an appointment?
Just tell Colonel Scarnoff that Captain Lockwood is here to see him.
No appointment? Outside, please.
Now, one moment, madam.
Outside?
Just a minute. I demand to see your superior officers at once.
Not so loud.
Now, you're not going to stop me.
I'm the leg triumphant over his neck.
I don't want to hurt you, madam.
You've wrestled him to the ground.
Yes. Where's the referee?
Actually, the director came up and he said, well, you earned us an M instead of a general. I said, what's the matter? He said, you showed your panty. I said, "I've got you. Got to be joking." He said, "I said, put those up because it was part of the thing. I mean, a good Russian spy in those days wouldn't wear scanties. You know, she wore panties and bloody cold in Russia."
So you were a spy, great.
They made me look as plain as I possibly could be.
But here, this is by the gaslight.
Oh, yes. Well, this is when I was working in cabaret, of course.
Singing and
playing guitar and, you know, doing... Well, you see, if you want to be in show business, you've really got to be able to do anything and everything, because there's not enough work to be in movies or on the stage or doing the twice nightlies or something. You know, you're forever trying to look for work.
The Olympics? What's that?
Well, I was in the movie Geordie, which was about the 1956 Olympic Games. I was playing Helga, the lady champion shot putter.
It's all over there.
See, with Bill Travers and over there.
So was it kind of glamorous back then?
Darling, show business is never glamorous. We're glamorous on stage. It's a bedlam out backstage, let me put it that way.
So you never feel glamorous or...
No, it's like, you know, the clown. You put on the makeup and you do the job. Hello, Hollywood. Just a tip. There's a lot of misconceptions about show business. Show business is a business. So you have to treat it as a business. If you take the thing, oh, isn't it wonderful and great, you're never going to get anywhere. You've got to treat it as a business. You've got to treat it as a study. Day I sat in Whitlam Square, and the trees and the sun and the clear blue air, and the foraging birds on the grass were there in Whitlam Square. This is about the people who died in AIDS. And going back to the 80s now, and a lot of people said, "Oh, good, we'll get rid of the gays and the druggies." And I thought, how awful that they could do that. That's where when I did my Whitlam Square song, and the trees and the sun and the clear blue air and the foraging birds on the grass were there in Whitlam Square. Today I sat in Whitlam Square. And as I wept, I said a prayer for the one no longer there in Whitlam Square. Pattern thread in a silken square remembers the one no longer there. That's when they made the big quilt, and everybody put a little bit of design into it to remember. And like the Rainbow Society, you know, for people who have died from AIDS. And, I mean, so what? They're people. I just find people are so aggro, and it gets down in some sense to a religious prejudice. I think people are prejudiced against other people. They're prejudiced against black people. They're prejudiced against yellow people. They're prejudiced against red people. No, they are. You know, we're slightly better. We're white and we're educated and we speak English correctly, you know. These people that can't hardly talk the language, you know, why should we listen to them? We must. And that is the answer. We must listen to them. It's not racial. I think it's social. We're better than they. We're, you know, who's this fella? You know, who does he think he is?
And heat against the chill and black of night compete. A flickering light, snuffed by a breath so slight it can't be felt against the skin. Comes death, and darkness dwells within. How can light keep at bay the terror the night. My light to yours is given, then without pause yours to another, and another yet is given. Night.
Both my husbands died. However, that happens. Both died of heart problems. It's funny, isn't it? First husbands had a pacemaker which failed. And my second husband was blown up in Korea when he was a young man, and it stretched his heart muscles, and he actually died of war wounds, even though it was quite some years afterwards. See, once you receive a war wound, you're under TPI, the heart muscle stretched and you can't put it back. It's like you blow up a balloon. Yeah. It never goes back to its original shape, does it? Yeah. And they can't shrink it back. And actually, that's what he died of. The heart eventually gave out.
Do you miss him?
Of course I miss him. I miss him every bloody day. But, you know, what can you do about it? Life goes on. No. You can't sit around and cry all day. People get a bit sick of that. I say, wake up, Doris. Well, you know that's true.
But you're here all the time. I mean, it seems like there's so much going on around you.
Well, it is. But it doesn't staunch the wound. It's there. I miss him every day. But it's what you have to... It's part of life. In the midst of life, you are in death. But I think that's in the Bible. You know, we had a good marriage. But I can't understand people, you know, they war. They go to war. They think marriage is the opening salvo. And I don't remember having the slightest argument with him in that 21 years. I really don't. I mean, we might have had a few, I think maybe we should do this. And he might say, well, I think maybe we should do that. But we never had any animosity at all. And how could you possibly be married to somebody that you were fighting with, for goodness sake? I mean, I've seen some girls, and they think unless they tearing the eyes out of their husbands, you know, they're not getting looked after. I find it, to me, I can't understand that. Amity, I think it should go together with matrimony. You have to compromise, of course. Every marriage is a compromise between two different people. But if you respect is the name of the game, if you respect your partner, you won't go wrong. We all feed on each other, in loving as in life, the child, the parent and the lover, the husband and the wife. Lovers kiss and promise that one will dominate the other in a silken shroud. We'll slowly and that was the image of Australia, these big strong men looking after the women. Women probably wore two black eyes every Saturday night, but that didn't come out. But I remember my grandmother, well actually my great grandmother, he said, "Oh Maggie," this was to his wife, he said, "I'm not going down to the pub anymore. I can't stand it." He said, "Because I can't bear these blokes boasting about how they beat up their wives over the weekend." You know what I mean? And, yeah, tell you something, they'd walk with a bloody limp if they did it to me.
I've only just met her this afternoon. Like, I've heard about her for years and known the legend of this Hollywood B-grade movie star that started this bar and has kept it all original and, you know, comes down here every now and then and plays the guitar and... necessarily talented in that respect, but, you know, it's her bar and she, like, runs it the way she wants it. Comes down and entertains. It's good.
Thanks for the memory of sentimental verse. Nothing in my purse, and chuckles when the preacher said, for better or for worse.
Do you think you know yourself now?
It's a slow growing into yourself. From when you were a child, you grow up and you're learning, and you have bad experiences and you have good experience. You're on a big learning curve. When you get to my age, you're, I think, a little bit more placid. You know, you're like a ship on a calm sea. Early on, it can be pretty rough.
Was your mother at all theatrical or dramatic?
Well, actually, I think she had a talent that could never be developed in her day. It was hard enough developing it in my day. You know, women... I still don't think the girls get a big shake in the industry, even today. I mean, you look at the big stars, they're blokes. There's a few girls that make it through. Well, I'm Nicole Kidman is a lovely little actress. Well, she's not little, but, she's so thin. You know, you look at her and you say, oh, only I could lose a few pounds. I might look like her. I think they've got a few Australian actresses now that are going to get a chance of being the big star in their own right. You know what I mean? But normally, particularly in my age, you were just there feeding the men. You know, the bloke was the big star, and, you know, if you looked a bit all right, you might get a chance to stand next to him.
You seem to have a really kind of quick to laugh, I would say, quick to find the joke. Do you think that's something that you've learned over the years?
Well, I've worked a lot with the top comedians, and I was a very good comic feed. And a comic feed, of course, has to prepare the joke for the comedian to take the... You see. So you have to be very, very, very serious in how you build up, because you're there to make him look good. I mean, you're getting paid too. Don't misunderstand me. But if you're a good comic feeds are hard to come by. I mean, you take George Burns and Gracie. He was a great comic feed. He never took a joke. He just sat there with the guitar and fed her the lines, and she got the laugh. You understand, that's what a comic feed is. And I was good at it. I didn't want the laugh. There's nothing more serious than good comedy. You cannot try to be funny. It doesn't happen. You have to be dead set serious. And then you get the pie in the face. I mean, you can look sideways and let your lip tremble a little bit. But you can't. You're there to feed the comic.
Have you always taken that approach to life?
Darling, I know how to read a line. I know how to feed a line. But not too close. He might bite me.
One aspect, I think, which was quite interesting, when we think of Doris and you see those pictures on the wall, and you think of the beauty of the woman then, but she has this really strong inner beauty that still kind of resonates within the walls of the Hollywood.
You're very doing, isn't it, just
Well, I mean, it's almost an emergency.
In conversation, I was just talking about I'm having a bad hair day. And then she goes on to talk about her hair, and she's wearing this short wig, sort of blondish, sandy-coloured, wavy kind of bouffant wig. with red lipstick on, so she still likes to look good. And she sort of lifts up her the corner, the edges of the wig, and reveals underneath there is dark brown hair. And here's me trying to sort of say I'm having a bad hair day. I need to dye my hair because I'm having grey hair shooting through my hair. And she shows me her hair that's actually darker than it's ever been in her life, which is sort of emanates her true character and her true spirit.
I don't feel old, and I don't think I think old. I think young. You know, I'm still planning ahead what I'm going to do. And I still sing.
Ay, 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 Sevilla, yes. Ay, 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 la ciudad del amor. La reina del cielo andaluz. Por la gracia de Dios.
¿Sabe usted hablar español?
Un poquito.
Sí. Yo estaba viviendo en España y trabajando también, tocando la guitarra y cantando. I used to sing in 14 different languages, but only one song. Because when I was working around, you know, the traps in the Orient and in Europe, you had to sing at least one song in their language. You see, you could make up your repertoire in all the different languages, and see, but you had to sing at least one in their language. Sevilla is the queen of Andalusia. That's basically what it says. Ay, 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 Sevilla, yes, ay, 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 la ciudad. I sang that, actually, on the Gladys Half Hour with Spike Milligan. Many, 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 many years ago. And the thing was, at the end of the thing, I take a bow, and as I come up, they put a pie in my face. I thought it was a gas, but I knew it was coming. But the ABC people, you know, but the classical, they couldn't see the joke. And their telephones were jammed. How dare they do that to that lovely singer? I thought it was a gas. But they didn't see the joke at all. Well, I suppose it is a long time ago. I think they've got a little bit used to the kind of craziness.
You could do something... Oh, I just, you know, summertime or something like that.
Okay. I always do summertime.
Yeah. So I'll just set it up.
I'll give them a little song. I only sing the one song, Summertime, you know. It's easy. I could sing anything with him and he'd follow me. He's very good. Best accompanist.
You remember the show that we did?
We did an hour and a half, didn't we?
That's right, an hour and a half show. It was. I think it was 2003 because it was called The First 73 Years Were the Hardest.
Yes, that's right. We should go to some of these festivals, darling, you and me. I'll get my guitar out and start practicing again. What is it, the Waratanga or something?
Oh, the Wangaratta one.
Why don't we go down?
Well, we should organise it.
And what do we call ourselves? Bonnie and Clyde? Oh. Take the bloody pistols. If you don't like it, you're in line. We've got to do The Spider and the Fly.
Oh, The Spider and the Fly. That's a great tune, yes.
And I think we've also got to do the Princess Diana song.
That's right.
I much prefer my life to Prince Charles's life. Yeah. I mean, he's had a pretty messy life too. He had to spout and shake hands with his mother. Mm. Can you believe that? Mm. I mean, it's bloody awful. But that was the protocol of the day.
That's right.
Stuff protocol, say I.
The title of your next tune.
I don't think I'll write it anymore. I might. You know, I'm 77 now and I say, oh, Doris, you know, just lay back and enjoy. But unfortunately, I don't have any fella to enjoy it with.
Yes.
It's all finito.
You can still live for the gig.
Oh, we can live for the gig. Yeah, we can live for the gig.
Live for the gig.
Not for the giggle.
Not for the
giggle. Now, I'm afraid my giggles are all played out, darling. But one never knows.
I lost myself in Woolloomooloo a week ago today. I'd come to town from out of it to have a little play. I started off at Central and ended at the Quay. I asked a fellow where to go, here's what he said to me. Oh, this is the way to the zoo, the zoo, the zoo, the zoo. The monkey cage is pretty well full, but there's room enough for you. You get a bus at Wynyard, at 6 o'clock it shuts. And I'll be out on Sunday, kid, with a great big bag of nuts. Nuts, my beauty, nuts, my beauty.
Well, darling, I'm going to retire gracefully now, darling. I'm a 77-year-old lady, and you talked me out, so I'm on my merry.
I looked at everyone, but nobody looked at me. I'd heard about King's Cross and thought I'd give it a try. I asked a fellow where to go, and this was his reply. Oh, this is the way to the zoo, the zoo, the zoo, the zoo. The monkey cage is pretty well full, but there's room enough for you. You get a bus at Wynyard, at 6 o'clock it shuts. And I'll be out on Sunday, darling, with a great big bag of nuts. Nuts, my beauty, nuts, my beauty, nuts, my beauty, nuts. I'll be out on Sunday, dolls, with a great big bag of nuts. I ended up on Bondi Beach. I wore a neck to knee. I didn't want to go to jail for dressing scantily. I asked the beach inspector the safest place to dip. He looked me up and looked me down and then he pursed his lip. Ah, this is the way to the zoo. The zoo, the zoo, the zoo. The monkey cage is pretty well full, but there's room enough for you. You get a bus at Wynyard, at 6 o'clock it shuts, and I'll be out on Sunday sport with a great big bag of nuts. Nuts, my beauty, nuts, my beauty, nuts, my beauty, nuts. I'll be out on Sunday sport with a great big bag of nuts.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
A Tale of Two Hollywoods included the voices of John Maddox, Angela Stretch and Chris. And a special thanks to the Hollywood Hotel's Chrissy, Mark and Ivan. Sound engineering was by Timothy Nicastri. The producer was Regina Botros, with a special thanks to Nick Franklin. And if you'd like to view images of Doris and her Hollywood, please log on to our website at abc.net.au/rn/radioi. On Radio I next week, we look back to the late 1950s, when a radio program went to air from London that had a major effect on the listening public. It was about the heroic death of a train driver on a runaway train, and it was the first time real people, instead of actors, were used to tell their own story. The story itself was set to song by two of the country's most revered musicians, Ewan McColl and Peggy Seeger.
We present The Ballad of John Axon, the real-life story of a railwayman told by the men who knew him and worked with him, and set into song by Ewan McColl.
John Axon was the driver, and he rode the train all the way down trying to warn people.
On the 9th of February, John Axon drove away in a Class 8 locomotive from Buxton he did go. On the road to Chapel on Lay Frith, his steam brake pipe did blow.
Charles Parker saw this story in the newspapers. Ewan and Charles had passed each other in the corridors of the BBC up until then. But Charles came to Ewan and he said, I want to do a lonesome train on John Axon. He wanted to do a lonesome train on the hero because it was a very heroic act. I think they managed to clear something off of the track in the station at the end of the 7 mile drop.
The engine had reached the distant signal when the broken steam pipe began to scream. John Axon and his mate couldn't reach the driver's brake, for the cab was full of scalding steam. Poor boys, the cab was full of scalding steam. John Axon, he knew that his regulator was still wide open and on full power. He couldn't turn it off for the way that it was blocked, and the cab was full of scalding steam. Poor boys, the cab was full of scalding steam.
Plenty of music, great stories, and three remarkable radio pioneers. That's next week in Scene to Song, the story of the making of the BBC's famous radio ballads. That's next week in Radio I. Coming up in a few moments, another piece from our series, Stories About Silence. You're listening to Radio I on ABC Radio National. I'm Brent Clough. A few weeks ago, we began a new series, Stories About Silence, which examines the idea of silence as a presence loaded with meaning, rather than as an absence of sound. In our next story, two women, a Holocaust survivor and another whose father was a Holocaust survivor, explore the silence in their families. This is Silenced by the Unspeakable.
I think there are survivors who haven't spoken about it for lots of different reasons, who can't or have chosen not to. But I think it's an illusion. They're under an illusion to think that by not talking and by keeping silent, that they are not, in fact, communicating. I think that silence is a powerful form of transmission of the experience in its raw, absolute raw form. And so it's a way of screaming about it. It's actually not silence. It just looks like silence.
When I came to Australia, it was already... We arrived here in 1950 on the 10th of March. We left Romania in 49. We lived in Vienna for a year, and then we emigrated to Australia. So at that time, the Holocaust, it was very, very fresh still in me. It gave me nightmares. I was sweating, I was excitable, I felt in my bones, you know, what I went through, and I survived.
My father was born in Czechoslovakia and grew up there in a small town near Irshava. And he actually was in quite a number of concentration camps. I know that he started off firstly in Auschwitz, and he was moved through quite a few concentration camps. He was only a young boy, and he ended up, the last camp was Gusen 2. He had been in Gusen 1, that was dismantled, and he ended up in Gusen 2. And at that point, the war was coming to an end. The Americans were coming through, and he was on what's called the march, the final march, where a whole lot of concentration camp survivors were marched through the forest and were dying, basically, and being killed along the way. And he survived that march and to be liberated by the Americans.
What happened to us, it's never ever can you tell what we felt and what they have done to us in many ways, of physically, emotionally and mentally. It's unspeakable, unanswerable. Only a person who went through that can feel that way, not other person, which is understandable.
It's interesting what my father actually talked about, because on the one hand you might say, I do know a lot about the history, but there's knowing and not knowing, and I think I both know and I don't know. So Dad talked, there were quite a lot of stories, but they were the same stories that he repeated to us, and I can't remember when he would have first started or how old I was. I feel like I've always known. But they were always the same stories, and I think what was significant was both what he said but also what he didn't say. So it feels like my knowing, there's a knowing in terms of facts and details and stories, but then there's a completely other sort of knowing that I think is more in my body and that doesn't have words.
What shall I say, that if I, for my sons, if I explain, I don't think they are affected strongly by it, because they never knew the real things that we went through. So we don't talk about it anymore.
Were you protecting them?
Not really, because I wanted them to know, and my husband explained them quite often.
But you said they didn't know what really happened.
No, they didn't know, because you can't explain. You explained them that I was deported to Auschwitz, and from there I was selected for work, and from there we were liberated. But you can't tell the struggling, the hunger, the dirt, the fear.
So you just gave them the facts?
Just the facts. They can't even understand that. I mean, what happens in between. I mean, I am deported, all right. But they don't know what happened after that.
Well, your son is 51 now. He could understand it now.
Yeah, he understands, I'm sure, but we don't talk about it.
It's not that we could never broach the subject, so there wasn't silence in that sense, and my father certainly brought it up. But I think there's been tremendous silence in the sense that he spoke and we listened and we could ask questions, but it's so hard to even grapple with the idea about the silence, because I think it was a very silent silence, you know, or a more hidden silence. It wasn't so obvious as in, say, a family where the parent wouldn't say anything and it was, you know, not allowed to be spoken about. So in a way it's more confusing, but I think it's full of silence, full of, you know, like a story that you know just has so much that's ready to burst out of it. So I guess it's the bits, the silence is more what couldn't get spoken about, and you never know what can't be spoken about. You only can feel certain gaps, or you can feel things. It's a bit like, how do you know what you don't know? And I think that's a bit like living in a family where the Holocaust is so present.
It's not possible to tell how it happened, how you've been shaking, how you've been lying on this mud, how did you want to have a drop of water, how to feel a human being, you know. So there are things that you can't explain. You can't explain that, because that it's only a dramatic story. You never can tell the real story because it's inexplicable. It's not possible. You know, when you are selected, it's not possible then shaking who will be separated, like I was from my beautiful little sister separated. It was a heartbreak. Can I explain that on a tape? What I felt to leave my sister there, or a good friend, or shaking, where are we going, what are we going, what are they going to do us? To see a pregnant woman, to labor, to give birth to a child, and the child goes in a bucket and in the toilet, to see that, how can you that explain the feeling? It's impossible to explain verbally. I adored my parents, my father. How can you explain what you felt that you came home and nobody, you don't find anybody? And things like that, millions, which I can't even explain, or it's only in my mind, you know, hidden in my mind.
Why does my father say some stories and not others is a good question. I'm not sure why. I think the stories that Dad has told us have very powerful themes, and they're to do with survival, with being strong, with miracles, with hope, if I think about it. So each of those stories, like there's even a story of the last time he saw his father, which is devastating, but his father went off to blow up the crematorium. So his father was, you know, he was a hero in that sense. So I, looking back on it, I can see the stories have a theme about hope and being positive and prevailing. So probably now as I speak, I can hear that maybe what isn't spoken was the other side, the no hope, the despair, you know, the terror. It's alluded to, it's sort of, it's implicit in, I guess that's it. There's a lot that's implicit in those stories or that you could deduce. But the main themes are about hope and positivity. And even now, I have a son who's 4 years old. My father is telling him the same stories. The stories of hope, the stories of survival. He's telling him the same stories.
You have 4 grandchildren. Do you think you'll tell them about your experiences?
No. You can't live with the past. It's in your mind, in your subconscious mind, always. But you can't live with it to get involved emotionally, what happened 63 years ago.
So you don't think it's important for your grandchildren to know your story?
They know that I was in the concentration camp. They know that. And it was horrible. They know that. But we don't talk about it. They know. But they are so sensitive. When I even touch the subject, they close in. Because they are afraid that I get upset. Because I have a very mild heart condition. We don't talk about it. And you know how young people are. They are living their life and they don't want to know about the past tragedies.
it's possible that he felt we couldn't understand, but I actually think that he can't fully grasp the enormity of it. So this is my perspective. I think, how could he even begin to tell those other stories? And also, when I think about all the stories, I realise that unless you have a strong, you know, and he still is very optimistic, and he's a strong person. That's been one of the things he's emphasised with us. And maybe that's what you have to hang on to. So I don't know whether he didn't speak about the other stuff because we couldn't take it or we couldn't understand. That's possible. And maybe that is in the mix. But I also think what's in the mix is I don't think he has the words for it. There are probably words that approximate something that's indescribable. But I think, and I can see this through my father's life, that he's actually speaking a bit more now than he used to. And even now, when he says the same stories, occasionally there's something a little different that I haven't heard before. So it's getting slightly elaborated, very slightly. So the depths of horror, I don't imagine there are words. But I think there is something healing, maybe. There's something very powerful about being able to find at least an approximation or find some way of putting some words to what happened. Because also, if we have no words or no language, and if all we have is silence, then that's all the next generation has, and that's all then my son's generation will have. And I think the silence is what holds so much of the trauma and holds what can't be spoken, what can't be thought, what can't be felt, what can't be processed. So I think the silence, it's better to find the words than just live with the silence.
What happened to us, it's never ever can you tell what we felt and what they have done to us in many ways, of physically, emotionally, and mentally. It's unspeakable, unanswerable. Only a person who went through that can feel that way, not other person, which is understandable. That's it.
Thanks to Lily and Rochelle, producer Natalie Kessicher and sound engineer Andrei Shabanov. And don't forget that if you'd like to catch up with any of the last 4 weeks of our programs, you can find them on our website at this address, abc.net.au/rn/radioi. And there's also a guest book on the site for you to add your comments or suggestions. Love to hear from you. Studio production today was by Menny Wasserstrom and Lee Redfern. And that's the program. In the meantime, stay with Radio National for plenty more great ideas and lots of great listening.
Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.